everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It's December 16th, 2014, and we've got another great show lined up for you today, talking about my favorite subject, food, and its relationship to one of my favorite diseases, cancer. And we'll get into that in just a moment. I wanted to remind you, as I usually do, that my nonprofit is Responsible Eating and Living, and I hope you visit our site, responsibleeatingandliving.com. We have some fun things at the site. I will tell you a little bit more about that later. And anytime you have a question regarding this show or anything related to food, please send me a message at info@realmeals.org. I love to hear from you. I love your comments. And I haven't invited you to message me recently, so I thought I might remind you to do that. Great. Shall we get started? Okay. So I want to bring on my guest, Dr. Cynthia Thompson, who is professor in the College of Public Health and holds joint appointments in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and the College of Medicine at the University of Arizona. Dr. Thompson received her PhD from the Interdisciplinary Program in Nutritional Sciences, University of Arizona, and completed NCI-sponsored postdoctoral training at the Arizona Cancer Center with a focus on diet and cancer prevention. Her research emphasis includes dietary intervention in breast and ovarian cancer survivors, as well as behavioral interventions for weight control and metabolic regulation. She was appointed as the director of the Canyon Ranch Center of Prevention and Health Promotion at the Mel and Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health, a center whose mission is to support a healthier Tucson community. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Thompson.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, when I saw your recent research publication article in the Journal of the Journal of the National Cancer Institute on diet and ovarian cancer, I thought, I need to talk to this person. I was very excited to see that.
Yeah, well, there's not much out there, and so you're right. It is exciting to have an opportunity with the Women's Health Initiative to have enough information and enough cases to really start to tease this out and figure out what's going on.
So important. I can't underline how important this is. I know intimately because I was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer in 2006. Here I am 8 years later, thriving.
And wonderful.
Yay, me! I'm alive. And it's not by chance and it's not by luck. There were a lot of different things that contributed to my surviving and thriving, and a big piece of that is diet and nutrition. And I've been immersed in health and diet for a long time, so I had access to a lot of information when I got my diagnosis, but still it was so difficult to find information. So when I saw this study, I went, yay, let's talk about this. Let's dig in and see what you discovered.
Well, do you want, basically with this analysis, what we did was, it's not a trial, so just to be clear, what we did was look at data from a large sample of 161,000 postmenopausal women who were in the Women's Health Initiative. And within that cohort, we looked at just over 600 women who had developed ovarian cancer. And we looked to see what was their diet quality before they were diagnosed. So we had, they had told us what they were eating a few times over the course of the observation. And then we said, okay, if we look at the quality of that diet, does it predict survival? And basically what we found was that the women who reported higher quality diets had a 27% lower mortality rate over the period of follow-up. So, you know, just about 8 years, and really we see a significant benefit from the diet.
So that's a very significant number, and it comes from I don't want to say general data, but it's not really fine-tuned because it wasn't a specific test where you could really determine what you wanted to look at. You were just taking what you could from data that was already established.
Yeah, so what happens is that with a lot of these large observational trials, people fill out what's called a food frequency questionnaire. And these have about, oh, probably 100 to 150 line items where people tell us whether they eat it, how frequently they eat it, and when they eat it, what's their portion, small, medium, or large. And then from this, we developed a score, a diet quality score, and we applied what's called the Healthy Eating Index score. And what it does is it has 10 different factors that it evaluates, and then people are given high or low scores depending on how much they eat. So how much total vegetables, how much total grains, how much saturated fat, how much cholesterol, et cetera. And that becomes a composite score. And that composite score tells us the quality of your diet. The advantage of doing that over saying, oh, was it broccoli or was it grapefruit or was it, you know, whole grains, is that, you know, people eat whole diets with a variety of different foods. And while it's interesting and maybe exciting for the, you know, cherry industry if we find out cherries are good, it really doesn't help people because you can't eat a diet that's 100% cherries. So the quality score really says, okay, it's all about getting healthy things in and less healthy things out and making sure that day in and day out, the quality of your overall diet is healthy.
Well, here's what I like about that message. There are more pharmaceutical companies and supplement companies that want to sell specific things, and like a vitamin or some concentrated nutrient from something that they say will improve our health or reduce our risk for cancer or shrink tumors or whatever. But the message that we really need is that it's our overall diet, a variety of all the right foods, less of the wrong foods, that's going to make a difference in our health.
Absolutely. And it also gives people permission to say, you know, if I don't want to eat broccoli today, I don't have to eat broccoli today. But if I want to, I can. Mm-hmm. You know, to really say I can individualize how I get, you know, a quality diet.
Now, this was pretty general, and I know from my own experience, I honed in on some very specific foods because my understanding was they had tremendous power in fighting cancer, boosting my immune system, like cruciferous vegetables and mushrooms and things like that. Does a study like this encourage future studies so you can hone in on which of these foods do more good and which of these foods do less good?
Well, this study definitely supports the idea that we need to work with ovarian cancer survivors in trying to improve their diet. It also speaks to the fact that, you know, people should always think of a quality diet in terms of primary prevention, and understand that what you do today and tomorrow when in your 20s and your 30s matters when you turn 50 and 60. So I think it sends a few messages. In terms of finding magic foods, this trial really isn't going to, this analysis isn't going to give us magic foods. And in fact, I don't think we'll ever have the studies where, you know, we take 100,000 women and put them on a high mushroom diet for 20 years and go, okay, mushrooms matter. We have lower rates of ovarian cancer when people eat mushroom. And I doubt we're going to have the trial where we take women who have just been diagnosed with ovarian cancer and give them mushrooms and look at outcomes just for mushrooms. But I can tell you that we have a very large trial going on right now in ovarian cancer survivors. We call it the LIVES trial, the Lifestyle Intervention for Ovarian Cancer Enhanced Survival, where we're really testing healthy habits and whether they make a difference in terms of prognosis after you've been treated for ovarian cancer.
And who's participating in this study? so I'm just asking study, because I'm a survivor and I don't know about it. Nobody's asked me anything.
So this study is really recruiting people through what we call the gynecological oncology groups and the NRGs. So these are clinics throughout the nation who participate in clinical trials related to cancer. It's one of the few that's really focused on cancer and lifestyle. You know, many of the trials are trying new drug therapies and therapeutics, but this one is lifestyle. It is targeting women between 6 weeks and 6 months of finishing their treatment. Hmm. So we're really trying to hit that window right early after treatment, because that's when we feel many women are kind of ready to try something new, not totally overwhelmed, which can happen when you're going through treatment, as you probably know. And yet, if we go too far out, what happens is we get kind of a biased sample of people who survive the disease, and we can't really tease out the effect of this healthy lifestyle.
Mm, okay.
So we're really targeting, and it's very exciting, and the ovarian cancer community has really stepped up. We have, we're probably just under 500 women that we've recruited in around 2 years, and that is phenomenal for a national trial. Now, why a national trial? Because the good news is while ovarian cancer occurs way too much in too many women, it actually is one of the less common cancers, and any one site in the country would have a hard time recruiting over 1,000 women within a reasonable time period. So we hope to finish recruitment within 3.5 years. We're shooting for 1,080 women who will be randomized on this trial, and we're hoping we'll have answers within 5 years. But it takes time, unfortunately.
Yeah, it takes time, it takes money. But I believe, for the most part, the information you're going to find out is going to apply not only to ovarian cancer, but other cancers and other chronic diseases as well.
Yeah, and that's what we generally find. And, you know, I mean, I always tell people, yes, the message of healthy eating can be complex, but the good news is pretty much across the board, there are certain behaviors that kind of hold true, whether it's cancer you're trying to prevent or diabetes or cardiovascular disease, hypertension, strokes. You know, the message is pretty consistent, and it starts out with get to a healthy body weight and try to maintain it. Do your best to be physically active while you eat healthy, and then start tailoring those eating habits to make sure that you're getting all the nutrient-dense foods that you need.
Now, a lot of people are confused about what a healthy diet really is, and I don't even know that we would agree. But but there are many things that most of us who promote a healthy diet, one or another, will agree on, I think, the majority of foods that are important.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right. We all have our individual viewpoints on, you know, what constitutes a healthy diet. And these indexes, like we used in the manuscript, like the Healthy Eating Index, at least guide us so we can have some consistency in comparing groups of people across the world. But, yeah, you know, I would say I have a bias towards vegetables more so than fruit. Or I have a bias towards more green leafy vegetables, more so than, you know, iceberg lettuce. You know, I want to look for the ones that are really dense and bioactive. So, you know, I think, like you said, we don't have those confirmatory studies, but a lot of the basis for our feeling that a certain food is healthy come from smaller mechanistic research that say, oh, if you eat this, it improves your immune system.
You're getting a little fuzzy in the sound. I'm not sure if something's changed in where you are or what you're doing, but
I don't think so. Is
that
better?
That's better.
Okay, so I won't move from here. But, you know, I think that it's important that we realize that foods have a variety of different compounds in them that can be health promoting, and those compounds act in our body in a variety of ways to improve our health. So if you eat something like onion, it may reduce your risk of, you know, viral infection. It may promote immunity. It may also reduce inflammation. So you have to remember that that variety buys you not just a variety of nutrients and phytochemicals, but it also buys you a variety of kind of targets mechanistically that help you have a higher level of health.
Now, when I was diagnosed, I consulted with a number of different, very reputable doctors, and I will never forget some of the responses I got from some of them that I really didn't respect. And one of them really said that food had nothing to do with my outcome. It didn't really matter what I ate, and I didn't pursue working with that doctor. Because I knew differently. And I've recently heard, I was speaking with a cancer doctor from Memorial Sloan Kettering recently on this show, and she was saying that many of her colleagues really rely on hard science. And that's hard to come by.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One is, if you're looking for hard science, by that meaning hard cancer outcomes, you're talking trials that are, hundreds of thousands of people. Cancer is a rare disease, particularly ovarian cancer. So you just cannot fund in a 5-year cycle trial after trial testing different food compounds. It's not going to happen. And even when we try to do whole diet interventions with or without physical activity, if you look at the number of trials that are funded that do these behavioral interventions, they tend to be few and far between in comparison to drug trials, because the perception is a drug trial is going to give us a home run and a diet trial won't. And, I always find it intriguing because, for example, a colleague of mine, Rowan Chilbowski, was at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Conference last week and presented data from our Women's Intervention Nutrition Study conducted over 20 years ago, right? Low-fat diet. And what he's finding is a 56% better survival all these years later in women who had triple-negative breast cancer who were on the low-fat diet.
Wow.
So, and they lost a modest amount of weight. So we're not talking a lot, 4 to 6 kilos, not huge weight loss, but that small amount of weight loss in a postmenopausal woman through a low-fat diet cut the rate of, recurrence in half. That's pretty powerful drug therapy, in my opinion.
Has that been published, or that was just an observation?
He the original data was published about 10 years ago, the shorter term. He just published this in abstract form at the meeting, but, knowing Rowan, it will be out in the literature within the next several months.
Okay.
So, I think part of it is, we don't have nutrition as a standard component in medical education. When it is there, it tends to get less attention because there's a lot of things they need to learn, and I respect that. But then what happens is the assumption is if we didn't learn it, it's not important. And that kind of concerns me. And I think somehow we have to convince, the medical profession that, diet is not the be-all and all, and it's not going to be curative. That's not what we're talking about. But we're talking about, the potential to extend life, quality of life, reduce recurrence rates is mounting. The evidence is certainly mounting for lifestyles in terms of diet and physical activity. And we at least need to be aware of where we are with that literature.
You used a word, perception, before when you were talking about pharmaceutical companies and drugs versus lifestyle research and the funding, more the funding goes towards the pharmaceuticals because we perceive that it will have a greater impact. And I think that's such an important concept because I don't agree. I think that lifestyle is primary and the diet is primary, and it starts even before we're born.
Oh, absolutely. And I think increasingly we know that. But changing that perception is, you know, going to take evidence and, you know, a larger and larger body of evidence to, you know, kind of have a major paradigm shift in our approach.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about you and how you got into studying about ovarian cancer and nutritional science, and how did you make the connection and realize that this was such an important topic?
Well, you know, I think for me, I grew up in a home where we always had gardens and we ate healthy, and, you know, my parents set a good precedent for me in terms of being physically active and eating healthy. And I actually contemplated medical school and then realized I was in, I was a registered dietitian. I was working in the hospital setting back in the days when we first started doing bone marrow transplants. And one day I said, you know, oh, this is tough. Patients going through BMT suffer quite a bit during the process, and I would really like to prevent cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to my benefit, and I guess maybe a bit fortuitous, the Arizona Cancer Center at the time had the leading cancer prevention researcher in the nation, Dr. David Alberts, running the cancer prevention control program. So I went and met with him, and that was at the time when the WINS trial that I mentioned earlier, as well as the Women's Healthy Eating and Living trial, and both of those in breast cancer survivors, diet interventions, were just getting off the ground and moving forward. And, you know, my skills as a dietitian were obviously beneficial in terms of moving those trials forward at our university site. And, you know, once I started, I was, you know, addicted, so to speak. I mean, I love the opportunity to work with survivors, to help them make informed choices, to help them, you know, have an impact on their quality of life and their longevity, and have never looked back. I mean, now it's just a matter of more and more reward as we develop this body of evidence that's going to be so important to changing how we treat survivors of cancer.
And what's next for you? Are you working on some new research in this area?
Well, I mean, the LIVS trial that I mentioned is really a huge trial that we're undertaking now. We're about halfway through recruitment, have about 500 women across the country. We'll be recruiting up to 1,080. Recently got funded to look at blood samples from those women to see what are the nutrients in those blood samples that may be protective. Mm-hmm. What impact are we having with diet and physical activity on inflammation, on insulin and glucose metabolism, on body weight and adiposity? So we're going to be looking at a number of different things to kind of show what the mechanism is and how are these things working, because, you know, that is something that our research and medical colleagues want to know. How did it work? Even if we get the, you know, magic bullet and find that we have a huge impact on progression-free survival, there's still going to be those who want to know, how did we do that? And so we'll be studying all of those mechanisms.
The women that are involved in these trials, are they just reporting what they're doing, or you're recommending that they follow certain guidelines?
Yeah, so half the women are giving kind of the general guidelines on healthy eating and physical activity and sleep and wellness, and then the other half are given a more intense telephone counseling to kind of make specific behavioral changes. And so we're trying to see if, you know, it's kind of a comparison group. There's not really a control group. Kind of here's mm-hmm. what we tell people in the standard of care, and here's a group that we're going to rev it up a little bit higher and see if it makes a difference.
Now,
end of the day, we can help people.
Without a control group, when you publish this study, are people going to respond well to it or criticize that you didn't have a control group?
Yeah, so you have to look at the change by group over time. And we think we're going to have enough difference across the groups over time that it will be fine. The issue that you have to balance is you have people who have been diagnosed with, as you know, a disease that does not generally have a great prognosis.
Yep.
And so to tell a woman, oh, we're having this healthy eating and physical activity study, and we don't want you to do anything. Just sit on the couch and eat any burgers and fries and whatever, is not really ethically the approach we want to take. So what we want to do is say, okay, this is the standard of care. We tell people, you know, eat 5 a day, stay 30 minutes activity day, the standards that are out there. And now with this group, we're going to try and see if it matters if you do more.
Eat 5 a day, that's 5 fruits and vegetables?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I do know a number of different doctors over time who wanted to show that their approach really had an impact on one illness or another. And because of that fact where they had to have a control, they didn't want to subject some of the people in their trials to doing something that they knew wasn't healthy for them.
Yeah, really, exactly. So we end up with comparison groups rather than true control groups.
All right, so I'm curious, what is the intensive version of this study?
Well, I don't want to go into a lot of details in terms of, you know, contaminating the comparison arm, but, you know, certainly it's based on the current recommendations of being physically active daily, making sure you get enough vegetables and fruit, making sure that you monitor your fat intake and your fiber intake, and so all of those things are considered. And then it really is providing women a higher level of support through motivational interviewing to really make those changes in the real world that they live.
Well, sometimes just knowing there are people out there that are supporting you can make a tremendous difference in the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be looking at that. And we pretty much have designed this so that there's pretty equivalent support in terms of contacts with patients and making sure that we care about them and we're concerned about their welfare. So absolutely, that'll be something that we'll be able to look at, the number of telephone calls women participated in or the number of clinic visits they kept or those sort of things we'll track to see if contacts also may be influencing the overall outcome.
Has there been anything in your nutrition research that has surprised you in its outcome?
You know, I think not surprise me as much as frustrate me. A lot of times what happens in dietary trials is we get the healthiest people. So if I hang a shingle and say, come be on my diet trial, who do I get? I get the woman who probably has tried to keep a healthy body weight and has tried to be active and tried to eat her vegetables or fruit. And in reality, what I want is everyone. I want the Burger King to be vegan. You know, I want to get the variety of different approaches people take to their diet and their activity because that's the real world that I want to translate this information to. And so I think, if anything, my message would be, you know, if you have an opportunity to participate in a lifestyle study, don't rule yourself out because you think you might not eat very healthy or you think you're not very active. You are the exact participant that we want to support in making these changes.
I never heard that before, and that's actually rather fascinating, a fascinating point. But I could see how people individually make that assumption. I'm not right for this study because I'm doing all the wrong things.
But actually, that's the perfect candidate because we're likely to improve their health over time.
Yeah, well, I'd love to participate in one of these lifestyle studies, but where do you find out about them?
So the LIVS trial is actually in the National Cancer Institute database, and I know I've had a lot of women contact me by email over the last 2 years checking their eligibility, trying to find out more about the trial. We've been out talking to people at the ovarian, like the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition meeting, up the volume. We have it on websites. So we've been trying to promote it, and it seems to be working because we certainly have had really favorable recruitment in a very short time point period compared to a lot of other trials.
You know, you mentioned wanting to get that broad spectrum of people who eat at Burger King to the vegans, and I'm a long-term vegan. But even vegans, there are unhealthy vegans and there are healthy ones. There's a wide range just in that tiny category. It's so complicated.
It is. And, you know, I always say that we do have our Twinkie vegans.
That's right. I'm just curious, what do they serve at some of these National Coalition meetings when it comes to food?
And, you know, that's another interesting hot topic. You know, I go to a lot of different cancer meetings, and it's the gamut, as you know. I will put in a plug. We have a group here at the Integrative Medicine Center where we develop every year we put on a nutrition and health conference. And it's one of the few conferences I've been to where we have used the break times and the meal times to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And so every break is like one break could be teas of the world and how to drink different teas and the benefits of teas. And another break might be the dark chocolate and cocos of the world. And the lunch would, you know, maybe serve up something like salmon with walnut, whole walnuts chopped over, glazed with kale and butternut squash and lime juice. You know, I mean, we really do everything in our power to send that message. And I think that's something that's really important. I have another meeting that I'm involved with for the Mediterranean diet and health that's going to be in January here in our nutritional sciences department. And again, the message is food matters, and you need to use those break opportunities to train people up on how to eat healthy. But anyone who's done meeting logistics knows that it adds a level of complexity to what you're trying to do. But I think people probably learn as much from the breaks at these meetings when you do it right as they do from the meeting content itself.
Well, we've come a long way, but we have such a long way to go, because if you go to any kind of anti-smoking conference, a lung association, something or other, they're not going to be serving cigarettes and cigars at that meeting.
Right.
And yet there are so many different cancer-related or health-related conferences where they're serving cancer-promoting foods, not health-promoting foods.
Yeah, I think it's getting better, but, you know.
Well, I was just at the Head and Neck Cancer Conference keynote morning extravaganza event at in New York City a few months ago. This was sponsored by Memorial Sloan Kettering, and they were celebrating their 100th year anniversary of the Head and Neck Cancer Department. And the break time, I mean, it was a disaster. It was white flour foods, sugary foods. Everything was white and flour and cream cheese. And
yeah.
It was cancer food.
I think a lot of times the meals and breaks become an afterthought, and no mm-hmm. one really is charged with looking at the nutritional benefit and the huge opportunity to send a health message. I mean, it's just a huge opportunity. You know, I went to the American Institute of Cancer Research, World Cancer Research Fund meetings in D.C. I guess it was the end of October. They did a fabulous job of making sure that they were sending the message and walking the talk. So I think you're right. It's an important thing for us to evaluate, and we need to do it more consistently. I'm just hopeful that the message is out there, because as I'm going to more and more conferences, I'm starting to see that message. Now, the conferences I'm talking about are diet and cancer and diet and health. Mm-hmm. And so there's probably a higher level of awareness than there would be at a more generic cancer meeting.
Sure. Well, if you're including diet and cancer in the same sentence, that I think that implies that there's a connection.
Yeah, and so you ought to do it right. But really, everyone should be. Like you said, it really is. These are learning opportunities, and we should take advantage of sending the right message.
Well, I'm very happy that you got your research published. And when people Google diet and ovarian cancer, they can easily get this summary that states that healthy diets do make a difference in mortality and lowering the mortality risk with ovarian cancer. That's such important and good news.
Yes, absolutely. And like I said, soon we'll have a large trial that really evaluates this at a higher level of evidence. And I'm looking forward to those trial results.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to them too. So I'll be looking out for them. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Thompson, on It's All About Food. And I wish you very happy holidays.
Well, thank you so much.
Healthy
I appreciate
one.
The opportunity to talk about something I love.
Yes, I do too.
Take care.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. Okay, let's take a quick break, shall we? I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And we'll be back in just a few minutes. Hey, everybody, we're back. I'm back. It's December 16th, 2014. You're listening to It's All About Food, and I'm Karen Hartglass. Well, I really love that last segment because, as you know, diet is such an important subject for me, especially when we're talking about ovarian cancer. Now, I may not have the hard science that some medical doctors are looking for, but all I know is I'm alive, and I know, I just know it in my core that what I eat has made a tremendous difference. Now, this study that Dr. Thompson had done doesn't really hone in enough on the real power foods. And like she was saying, it's like next to impossible to do those long-term studies. We do the best we can. But I am a believer, as you probably know, in those dark leafy green vegetables, cruciferous vegetables, eating a lot of mushrooms, onions, and berries, staying away from the, not just the high processed foods, but flour foods in general. They should be eaten as treats, not very often. Sugar is a no-no if you're really going through a health crisis. Again, it should be really limited, and it makes a tremendous difference, and it's great to know that. So if you are unfortunately going through a health crisis, I hope this information is useful to you. And if you do have any specific questions about foods and my personal experience, the things that I did, I love to share that with people, to share what I did and what specifically worked for me. You can send me an email at info@realmeals.org, and I'd be happy to share what worked for me. So I mentioned visiting the responsibleeatingandliving.com website. We're, like many organizations, going into the end of the year fundraising drive, and we've got a nice letter up on the website talking about all the things that we've done this year, and we want to do a lot more. And Responsible Eating and Living is a nonprofit organization, and we're funded by individuals and foundations, and any help that you can offer would be gratefully appreciated. And we have a gift. We have a gift for everybody. So if you go to the responsibleeatingandliving.com website and click on the image right at the top of those two little Santas, one of them being me, you can listen to our latest recording of The Man with the Bag. It's really fun, and I hope you like it. And let me know what you think. Now, tonight starts Hanukkah for those who celebrate Hanukkah. And as I've said many times, I'm not a religious person, but I love holidays. I love traditional foods. And what I love is taking those traditional recipes and making them healthier, making them delicious, making them vegan, plant-based, and one of my favorite all-time traditional foods that I have not only modified but enhanced is the potato latke, the potato pancake. We have a food show that we created a few years ago, and it's kind of an annual thing to promote it and invite people to watch it. I tell a little bit of the story of Hanukkah about how the menorah, the special lamp that was in a temple long ago, special oil that was used to light the menorah, there was very little left, and it lasted for 8 days. It was a miracle. It wasn't expected. And as a result, the holiday is celebrated with eating oily foods. Now, I don't know who made that connection a long time ago, but I don't get that message from that story. The story was about being efficient with oil and extending the use of your limited resources so that they last a long time, not about using a lot of it, oil especially, and eating it. So some of the traditional foods are potato pancakes fried in oil and donuts fried in oil. And my message is save the oil for the lamp. Not that we're lighting lamps anymore with oil, but I think you might get the symbolism. We don't need to be eating foods fried in oil, especially as a celebration. It's a funny thing in our society how often we celebrate something wonderful by eating something that isn't good for us. How did that start, where we get rewarded by getting a food that's going to make us ill or not feel good? So I say, let's skip the fried food. And I have a wonderful potato pancake recipe that's baked, not fried. It's easy. It's so much easier than making those fried pancakes in oil where you're hovering over a hot oil, a frying pan with tons of oil in it. And for me, this is such a joyous experience, making these potato pancakes that are baked and not fried. They're delicious. There are different flavors. You can put different things in them if you want. And it's all explained in the food show. I hope you get to watch it at responsibleeatingandliving.com. All right. So I've told you about the song, The Man with the Bag, and I've told you about the baked potato pancakes. And I just wanted to mention I got a couple of new recipes on the website. I just put this one up today. I just made a cream of celery soup today for lunch, and it was so easy, and I loved it so much that I put it up on the website. And it's like no ingredients in it, or just a handful: celery, onions, white beans. The white beans are the cream. And you know how crazy I am about beans and how nutritious they are and how good they are for so many different things. They are a prebiotic. Beans are a prebiotic, which means they feed our probiotics so that we can have a healthy gut and a healthy colon. And they make us feel satisfied. And that's an important thing. I know when people transition to eating more plant foods or a plant-based diet, many people say, I just always feel hungry. And my response is, just eat more. Eat more of those wonderful, healthy vegetables. Eat big, giant salads. But beans especially are so, so satisfying. And I just whipped up this cream of celery soup. I hope you try it. Let me know what you think. And I'm stuffed. That's all. I wanted to talk briefly about something I recently discovered, and that is packaging. Now, I think I've mentioned that here in my home, I like to eliminate plastic as much as possible. And when I store food in the refrigerator, in the freezer, for the most part, I use glass. And I'm a big fan of those Pyrex bowls, and there are round bowls and there are square and rectangular containers, and they have plastic covers, most of them. And I prefer them with just a plastic cover and a simple plastic BPA-free cover than storing entirely in plastic. And what's great about these containers is you can take the cover off and you can serve your food in it, you can cook your food in it, put it in the oven, you can put it in a microwave. I don't microwave, but you can. And it can also go in the freezer and the refrigerator. I love this stuff, and I love storing food in glass rather than plastic. And I save glass jars, the wide mouth glass jars. I put soups and nuts and grains, everything I store in glass. And when I get foods that come in plastic packages from the store, I immediately empty them and put them in glass. Because over time, those plastics can really degrade and leach the things that we don't want, those hormone disruptors and all kinds of things, into our food. But I was looking a little more deeply into everything in my kitchen, and it's scary what you discover. So sometimes you don't want to carry a food in a glass container because it's heavy. Let's say I'm traveling. And what do you package your food in? Now, there are stainless steel containers that have come out. They're kind of pricey, but they're lighter than glass. But what about, I don't want to use plastic wrap, so what about wax paper, for example? And in reading about wax paper, have you heard about any of this? It's just every time I look into something, I open up another can of worms. So wax paper can be coated with a soybean wax. Doesn't sound so bad, but that soybean wax is likely genetically modified, and it's likely been from soybeans that have been grown with pesticides, so they have a little residue. And the other option, if you're not getting wax paper with soybean wax, then you're probably getting wax paper coated with a paraffin wax, which has a petroleum-based product. And in reading about it, that petroleum-based product is like the bottom of the barrel petroleum that they use for wax paper. So both of them don't sound very good to me. And then I'm a big, big fan of baking with parchment paper because you don't have to use oil on your pan. And if you have aluminum pans, because it's not so easy to find stainless steel baking sheets and they're more expensive, I like to protect my food and not have it touch the aluminum, and I don't want to use oil. So parchment paper is wonderful. Nothing sticks to it. And what about parchment paper? Some parchment paper is coated with silicone. That's not so bad. It's a non-organic natural product. But most parchment papers are coated with, I don't even know how this is pronounced, Quilon. Quilon, it's a chemical. It contains chrome, which is a heavy metal. And it can, when it's burned, incinerated, it becomes toxic. It leaves trace elements. And most of the parchment paper is coated with this stuff because it's cheaper than silicone. There are some parchment papers that have a vegetable coating on it, but I haven't been able to figure out where those vegetables came from, if they're organic or not organic, and what kind they are. So it's really, really a challenge. So I'm opting more and more to really do old-fashioned things. Like if I'm making a sandwich and that I want to travel with, I'll wrap it in a cloth napkin. Why not? It's reusable. And there are some healthy versions to do this. For example, you could make a wrap with a collard leaf. And a collard leaf is not only nutritious, but it's so sturdy that you could wrap all your gooey spreads and vegetables and things in a collard roll and then wrap that up in plastic. And you're not plastic, oops, wrap that up in a cloth napkin, and you're good to go. But it's just a challenge. We live in an extremely unnatural world, and I think any product that offers a certain amount of convenience comes with a price, and it's not just the price of purchasing that item. It's the price of what it may be what compromise are we involved in by using it that may affect the environment, may affect our health? So interesting to think about everything that we use in the home and how it's made. We can't take anything for granted. And the thing is, when it comes to chemicals like BPA coatings, which we now know are very toxic and unhealthy, often when chemical companies are told they can't make a certain product anymore, they come up with a new product, and that new product is great until we find out it isn't. So there are companies that have come out with a BPA replacement, Trilon, and we're learning that that really isn't any better. So any way you can avoid plastic, and there are different kinds of plastic and different grades of plastic, and some seem to be safer than others, but the best choice is to avoid them as much as possible. And it's not just because it's better for you and your family and your health, but ultimately for the planet. Because when those things go into landfills, they last a very long time. So that's it on packaging. And I was reading something, I think it was in the New York Times this week, and there was this one line that popped out. It was talking about the upcoming holidays and how more people are less excited about Christmas because of its relation to consumerism, and how it gets away from the ultimate message of peace on earth, goodwill to everyone. And there was one line that I really enjoyed, which was, what really brings us joy, which brings us bliss, happiness, is collecting experiences, not things. Collecting experiences, not things. So if you're thinking about the holidays, thinking about what to do, and you've got a list of what people want, and your limited budget, or maybe you have an unlimited budget, if you can think more about creating an event rather than giving something in a box, think about creating an experience, and that may be more treasured and more memorable in the long run. Collect experiences, not things, because that thing can get old. And when we're years later, when we think back, what is it we're thinking about? We're thinking about experiences, not really things. Okay, but meanwhile, if you are thinking about buying stuff, good luck. I know the things that I look forward to are things for my kitchen. And what is it that I want this year? I don't really know. Well, let me know what you're looking for, and you can send me an email at info@realmeals.org. I want to know, what do you want for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever you're celebrating? It would be fun to hear what's important to you. So on that note, let's say goodbye for now, and I wish you a very, very delicious week.